Time now to go to Sunday school with the professor.
Take it easy, will you?
Giants third base coach Ron Wotus with Marty Lawrence.
I didn't know you wanted to get involved with the discussion, Mr. Helper.
On your home of Giants baseball.
Good answer. Like the way you think.
KNBR 680, the sports leader.
I love it. That's the best part of Sunday morning, the intro, you know? Isn't it?
Well, it's, as I said many times, well done. It's well done. It makes me laugh as well,
Marty. It makes me laugh, too. All right. Well, last night was a tough game, and like I say, 56 still to go. But a tough game last night, and it's the ebb and flow of a baseball season, Woe, and you come out of the break. You want to win as many games as you can, and then you play some tough games in Oakland, go up to Seattle, you win one, another tough loss on Wednesday. And even the first two to the Brewers, you had shots to win, and then last night got blown out a little bit.
Right.
That's the story of a season, I guess.
Well, it's, you know, the ebb and flow, as you well say all the time. You know, you have streaks. You play well, you play poorly, you can't get a key hit, and then there's streaks where things go your way. You get to two-out base hit. You get on a roll. You play a cold team. Seattle's a good club. Milwaukee's certainly hot right now. They're a very good club. They can beat you in a lot of ways. They have power. They have speed. And their pitching is really improved. So, you know, the close game, we have to keep the games close. Last night was a tough one for me. It was a bitter pill to lose the way we did. That game didn't sit well with me. But hopefully we'll bounce back today and start moving in the other direction and getting the key hits and playing better baseball.
Yeah, you know, as we love to do on Sunday morning, take the game apart a little bit. And you said a phrase there, hitting with runners on third, less than two out, getting that hit when you need it. What is it about hitters today? And do they do it? Is it as conscious as it was, you know, 5 years ago, or has that part of the game changed?
I think it's changed a little bit. They definitely work on it. They definitely think about it because they want to get the RBIs. But, you know, years ago, you were really evaluated in a different way. You know, I think the RBI was very, very important. Here today, you hear a lot about home runs. And there were a lot of players that were good RBI guys. There was guys that they got rid of the game-winning RBI stat. You know, I mean, those were things that a lot of us used to pride ourselves and driving in that run that puts you ahead in the game. And there's an art to it. I mean, when you're a man on third and less than two outs, you really sacrifice yourself. If the infield's back and you're facing a tough pitcher, you just want to hit a ground ball and get the run in. Now, you get the RBI, but you don't get the stat. And I just wonder if today, sometimes, we want to do too much. We still want to get the hit. We still want to drive the ball out of the ballpark. You know, we were taught man on third, less than two outs, infield in. And it's still talked about, but you just don't see the guys giving up their at bat to get the run in. To hit a fly ball, get something up and out over the plate, something that you can loft into the air to get the run in. And a lot of guys were good at that. Tony Perez, I mean, he's one of the greatest RBI guys ever lived in these situations. And you just don't see it today. The swings are different, more swings and misses, more all-or-nothing type hitting.
Yeah, even in situations like that. Can you do it in batting practice? And I know they take batting practice. And even when I talk about batting practice, I talk about Mark McGwire or Guerrero or Cesar Cedeño or, you know, some of these great Barry Bonds. Batting practice should be working on things, I would imagine. Do they still do that?
They do. I mean, Rick Shue and Alonzo Powell do a great job with their hitters. And, you know, they're old school guys. They know the importance of the RBI and getting the run in, and they talk about it. But, you know, and it boils down to the player consciously wanting to get that run in and sacrificing themselves to some degree. You know, we all think about sacrifice. It's not a big sacrifice, but we think about it with a man on second. Second, nobody out. We say we got to hit the ball to the right side. Do you want to hit a ground ball to get him over to third? Even that today, I think, isn't as prevalent. You know, the big hitters, because they have power, you know, managers say, hey, drive the run in. And the pitchers, you know, some of these pitchers are throwing 95. They're throwing the ball away. I mean, they're throwing the ball in on you as a right-hand hitter. It's harder to get it done. So I just think the game has evolved. I think we're all at fault a little bit to some degree that these things don't matter as much. Maybe it's the sabermetric community. I don't know. You know, the value of the bunt is gone, you know, by the wayside and the stolen base. But I think when you're playing a close game, these things still show up to win games.
Which you are. All your games are close.
Right.
Just about every game turns on something. You tweeted about it at R. Wotus. Come on, you got out there this week at R. Wotus. Fans, if you're not following him, absolutely follow him. But you got out there a little bit on that issue.
Yeah, I that's who I am. That's as a player, that's the type of player I was. I watched the game today. And I see, you know, when we get beat, sometimes it's a stolen base that beat you. It's moving the runner. It's the sacrifice fly. And as you said, we play a lot of close games. So I played. I took pride in doing that as a player. Also, when I managed in the minor leagues, I won a lot of games that way. You know, when you're facing a tough pitcher, you don't expect to get 4, 5, 6 runs. You had to play for a run and try to beat him any way you can. So I've lived it. I believe in it. And certainly I did not have the power to hit the ball out of the ballpark. Maybe if I did, I wouldn't be talking like this.
You were an A-Rod, I take it.
No, not at all.
Not at all. All right. Ron Wotus with us, the professor on this Sunday morning. A couple of things. One, there was a play that Longoria couldn't make the other day, ground ball to third, and he bobbled it a little bit and got the change-up grip, and they showed it really well on TV. But what I thought about on that play, I guess it was a contact play on,
yeah.
But the runner, I was thinking about it because the ball was hugging the line, so to speak. It was right down the line where he was playing. And I said to myself, boy, if the runner is thinking like they run from first to second,
yes.
Get in the way.
Yes.
So he can't throw it. And did that happen?
Yes. I think to some degree it did. You know, you hate to not execute the play, but I thought he showed a lot of game presence and experience and not forcing that throw home because I don't think he had a good throwing lane. And it was going to be a bang-bang play to where he probably would have been safe. And a lot of young players would force it. They'd hit the guy in the back or they would still try to get him. Now he's safe and everybody's safe and we didn't get the out. You hate to give up that run, but you got to know if I don't have him, getting the out is very important. It was still just a 3-1 game at that point, and we still have a chance to come back. So, yeah, I'd have to look at it again. I saw the replay briefly. It looked like the runner tried to get in the lane to some degree.
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah.
I said, that was smart because he knew where the ball was. It was hugging the line.
Right.
So it's like the play, for like you've described for us so many times, first to second, get in the way.
That's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah,
and that's the perfect time. Yeah, yeah, good base running. And he got a good jump. You got to give him credit. There's another play that's not utilized all that much, the contact play.
Yeah.
You're going on contact. And everybody says, oh, when that play doesn't work out, and you're out by 5 feet, everybody goes, what are you doing? Why are you running into an out? Well, there you have it. You have speed at third. He went. It only takes a bobble, or you don't know if the ball is going to be hit to an infielder's left where he's going to have to reach for it. And when you have speed, speed puts pressure on the defense, and that's all it takes to get that run in. So just remember, next time the ball's hit right at somebody and the guy's out by 10 feet, you're trying to force the play. Because it works a lot of the times when you have speed.
So when you say contact play, if I'm the runner, when do I break? As soon as the ball leaves the bat and I know it's on the ground?
Well, the biggest thing is you want to fight to get the biggest lead you possibly can. And the second thing from there is you want to anticipate the ball down. You just want to see the ball, the angle, the swing, and the ball down. As soon as you see the angle of that ball down, you take off. You don't watch to see where the ball goes. So I think that the key is, like a lot of things in this game, is you have to anticipate, just like you would on defense, anticipate the ball being hit to you. If you're holding a runner, it's say, anticipate this guy's going to try to steal. I'm not going to let him do it. So you want to fight to get that lead, and you really want to be in motion. You don't want to be dead stopped at third. You want to time your secondary lead so that foot lands, and on the swing, you're actually breaking to home. The good players will be breaking the home on the swing, anticipating the swing. You need that type of jump if the ball's hit hard at somebody in the infielder. So you really, you know, and you're vulnerable there, Marty,
yeah.
because you're vulnerable to get picked off, yeah. and you're vulnerable to get doubled off on a line drive. But to get a run in, sometimes it's worth that risk.
Boy, that's good stuff. Boy, that, see, the professor. This is why you got to enroll in this course. This is very good. I learned something today just now. And that is, see, I always think, watch the ball off the bat when it hits. But no, that's too late.
That's too late on that play.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Oh, very good, Will. Very good.
You got it, Marty. It's my pleasure. Good yeah. to be with you this
all
morning.
All right. Then you got Allie and Carmen just soaking all this stuff up.
Yeah, they love it. They're baseball rats, aren't they?
Carmen.
Oh, gosh.
Go ahead. Carmen, what do you think about that?
What specifically about
learning a little bit of that on the contact play?
No, I mean, it's super interesting. I feel like every time we sit down with you, we learn kind of the nuances of the game, which is kind of what you were saying on Twitter, is that it's not just the box score. You really have to watch it and be able to tell what happened in between to really be like, what happened in this game? Where are kind of the strengths and the weaknesses, and where do we go from here?
Right. Well, I'm happy to hear that it's not boring to many people, because the game is viewed differently. Honestly, you know, myself, the big picture stuff, when we get into a game, sometimes I'm oblivious to it because it's just obvious. I don't pay attention to it, right? It's as coaches and people on the field, it's these other things that we can give you the edge in the execution that you're focused on to try to get your team to do. So I'm glad people are interested in this.
Right, Allie, you're on this.
It's just nice to be able, when we see something on the field, and then we can think about it a different way than our initial thought, and then we learn a little first.
Yeah.
And then we can watch the game a different way.
Yeah, I'm going to look at that contact play from now on, really, to see the jump.
It's another great play, you know, back when Vince Coleman, who's in our organization, was stealing all those bases, it was a lot more prevalent. And it looks bad at times, but, boy, when you have speed and it's executed properly, it can be an exciting play in a game.
Very good. All right, the other part of that, Longoria caught my attention a little bit. Then he made a play where he made a nice backhand play and crossed the line and made the throw to first. And it was Sandoval couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that long hop so much trouble for the first baseman? The long hop seems to give them the most trouble. Why is that?
Well, I'm not sure if it's the long hop or the in-between hop.
Okay.
We call it the in-between hop, right, Marty? The short one where you can,
exactly.
It has a short arc.
Right.
But the real long one is easier because you can just catch it. But the in-between hop.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, first base is more difficult because everything we do on the baseball field, other than when you're trying to touch or stay on a base, you move your feet to get the hop you want, okay. Right? So, you're at the mercy of that in-between hop. And sometimes the ball stays down a little. Sometimes it pops up. That's why you're taught when the ball is bounding, you want to go get that short hop where it doesn't have the opportunity to stay below your glove. You move your glove forward through it, get the short hop, or you back up or take a drop step. You see infielders, who comes a ground ball, they move their feet and they drop back to get the long hop. The in-between hop is the one that you may get the error on because the ball is not consistently doing what it's doing. And when you're at first base and you get into that position, you can't move your feet to get the hop you want. You're at the mercy of just picking it. And a lot of times you don't come up with it.
Yeah, when you say picking it, that's the other picture I have in my mind. The first baseman just doesn't stay there trying to get it steady. He's swiping at it.
Yeah.
And that's where the trouble starts.
Yeah. Well, he's got to make a move forward through the ball. Everybody does it a little bit different. But, you know, you talk about infield play. And, we always say that your feet, good feet make good hands. Everybody says, oh, he's got great hands. Yeah, a lot of people do have great hands. But if you have bad feet and you don't move the feet to get the hop you want, your hands are going to look a lot worse. So, you know, watch the footwork of guys and the infielders and, you know, jumping rope or things I did as a young player, short steps. You know, the guys now, when guys take long strides to the ball, you know, Alan Hansen was a guy that when he first got here, he didn't use his feet correctly, and subsequently he's getting can you say that word for me, Carmen?
Subsequently.
Subsequently.
Yeah.
Subsequently.
Okay.
Is that a word? Is that a word?
So.
All right. I better go back to my own vocabulary here. You know, you get a lot of...
Stay in your lane. That's
yeah, I'll stay in my lane. Okay. You get a lot of in-between hops, and that's where errors come because you can't be as consistent with those.
Boy, interesting. All right. This is good stuff on this Sunday morning. The Brewers tried to steal a bag last night up by, I think it was 6. At that point, you don't see that too often, I must tell you. You don't see that very often.
No, 6th inning. It was a 6th inning. Look, you're playing in Milwaukee, you're playing in Chicago, and he's with the wind blowing out these small ballparks. You know, it's a 6th inning. You don't see it a lot, but, you know, I understand it. They're playing to win, and they're going to be aggressive. But the one that I did not care for that set poorly with me was up by 5 in the 8th inning. You know, we're in this ballpark. We're not scoring a lot of runs. You got to look at the big picture. And when you're out of grand slam range, you know, Dusty, and when I got to the big leagues, of course, when I played in the minor leagues, that was always the measuring stick, right? If you're out of grand, you know, the other team can load the base into grand slam, and you still have the lead. That's when you shut down the running game. And when you only have 6 outs left, and they're stealing a base with a 5-run lead. The way they're playing, that didn't sit well.
Yeah, it's so noted, I guess, in the world of the unwritten rules of baseball. That was one that was definitely noted. A lot of things happened. Boy, so many things happened in the game. You know, you look at the final score and maybe the last pitch or how the last run is scored, but there's so much that goes on in the game beforehand that dictates what happens. And last night, McCutchen. Now is in the leadoff spot, and I realize you want to get something going. You're going to shake the lineup up. You're not picking names out of the hat, you know,
right.
But you're going to do stuff. So he had a delayed steal, and I wasn't sure what he was doing, but it was, I guess, a delayed steal. So what is the theory, and what happened with him?
Well, he's on his own, so he's leading off. He's you know, trying to get us going. We've been not scoring as many runs as we like, so he wanted to make something happen, and he chose to delay steal opposed to straight steal. And a delay steal is usually set up by the infielders on defense. When the shortstop or the second baseman are far away from the bag at second, that's when you delay steal, because you break right away, they break to the base. But on a delay, you take your one or two normal shuffles so the infielder relaxes, he doesn't expect you to go, and then you take off. Now, what happens there, that time of the infielder relaxing is typically enough time for you to beat them to the base, because now they can't get to the second base in time. But I didn't see their positioning on that play, whether, you know, they were not far enough away or what. But obviously they got there in time, and he was out. So that's the idea of the delayed steal. You want to freeze the infielders, and then if you have good speed like McCutchen, they can't get to the base in time.
So you look where the shortstop,
yes,
second baseman.
Yes, yes. That, you know, if they're playing close to the base, you wouldn't try a delayed steal. But if they're far enough away from the base, that's the time to do it, to take a shot at the delayed steal.
All right, so not a bad play.
No.
I guess not a bad play.
No. I mean, it's
you don't see it too often, though.
You don't see it too often, but it's a very effective play at different times in the game. And as I said, if the infielders are, you know, in the right position, that alerts you to say, hey, you know, this is a time where I could delay and be safe.
Very good. Duggar took off for second. He got thrown out. Then, you know, everyone in the stand, well, you're down by so many runs. Where are you going? What about that play?
Well, that's an aggressive move on his part. You know, we are down. And, you know, I talked to him after the game. And the thing that I like about it is he's trying to get to the next base. There's so many times this ball's in the dirt, and guys are just, they're just standing at first base and they don't try to advance. Now, having said that, I think if it happens again, he's going to temper his aggressiveness because of the situation of the game. The scoreboard dictates. And in that scenario, if you're out, you don't want to be out in that scenario because we're down by too many runs. So aggressive move, with that score, he's got to be a little more sure that he can make it on that play.
Yeah, I thought their catcher was pretty good last night. I thought he threw the ball. Didn't they throw it?
He did. He made a great play. You know, when that ball kicked away a little bit, he got to it quicker. It bounced right to him, and he threw a rocket to get him at second base. So it was an impressive throw on his part. And, you know, when you're not winning, those little things seem to go against you as well, right? And he makes a great play, and now he's out, and it's not a good play for us.
Boy, interesting. Boy, it's great baseball stuff this morning. Good baseball stuff. The other one, I was thinking, I have to have a phone connection to you during the game so we can ask you all these questions here. But you flip the shortstop and third, they flip back after a couple of strikes.
Right.
Explain that again to me, why you do that.
Well, you know, there's a lot of teams that shift, obviously, and everybody does it a little bit different. But I think most people do it in a consistent way. You know, you want your shortstop at shortstop as much as he can be there. You know, some teams, okay, when they shift, they'll put the shortstop at third base and put the third baseman over on the second base side, thinking my shortstop has the most quickness. Okay. He has the most range, so we'll let him play the bunt. And we'll put the third baseman over on the second base side where there's already two other guys. He doesn't have to have as much range. Typically what we do is we keep Crawford over on the second base side because usually when you shift, you're expecting the guy to pull the ball. And he's our gold glover, and he's used to playing in the middle. So we'll keep him there. And the same thing with the third baseman. We'll keep him playing the bunt. Because that's what he does his whole life. He's a third baseman. He's familiar with the bunt, and he's probably more adept at that play because he does it all the time. So we'll keep Longoria at third base to start, and then when the bunt is out of order,
okay,
and there's no risk that they're going to bunt again, which there's always a risk, but right. When we feel he won't bunt, we'll send the third baseman over to the second base side and then put the Crawford or the shortstop back to shortstop, his normal position. So that's the reason behind it. Everybody does it a little bit different, but that's the way we like to do it.
So that's basically two strikes, perhaps?
It depends on the hitter, two strikes. Some guys in this league, they will get one strike, they're not going to bunt. You know, the count, the scoreboard, the whole situation of the game. And that's the biggest fear in a shift, is that's why it's so important that these shift guys bunt once in a while. Is, you know, for me, I mean, you hate to have that whole left side exposed and the guy standing out there for the bunt, the third baseman, and three guys on the other side. But when you do shift and the guy drops down the bunt and now he's on base, you know, it's a one-run game or whatever it is, or there's nobody out. You don't want that bunt to happen when there's nobody out. Now it's the start of the inning. If it's a home run hitter with two outs and he wants the bunt, maybe it's better. He didn't hit the ball out of the ballpark. So the outs, the scoreboard, it all comes into play.
That was that article I gave you a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
I don't know if you got a chance.
I have not had a chance, but I do want to look at it this trip.
Yeah, that explains why people don't bunt against the shift, because then it would take three hits to score you.
Right.
And they would rather hit over the shift than try to Murphy of Washington.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, that's still the old philosophy that we all came up with playing this game. And you know, if you're not a base stealer, a true base stealer, don't bunt with two outs, they say, right? We were taught, you know, and I come 1979 rookie ball, Woody Hickey with the Pittsburgh Pirates, and I'm learning professional baseball. You know, they taught you the way the game was played. And one of them was, unless you're losing, you know, in the seventh, eighth, and ninth inning by a few runs, or you need base runners, you don't bunt with two outs. If you have any power in your bat, you want to hit a double because you can hit a double, and now you score on a base hit. Two hits, you score, right? So, that changes. Say you're down by three runs in the ninth inning, and they're giving you the bunt. Why wouldn't you get on base? You don't need this. You need two more hits anyway. So everything changes with the outs and the scoreboard in a game situation.
Boy, interesting. All right, we'll take a break. The professor is with us this morning. I know Allie and Carmen have a couple of questions, but it is Hall of Fame Sunday. And some very significant people going in the Hall of Fame. Bruce Bochy is back there for Alan Trammell and for Trevor Hoffman. But, well, I want to get some of your just gut reactions. If I give you a few names, what you know about them as Hall of Famers. You've been around for most of their careers. You've seen all of it. So, all right, we'll come back with Ron Wotus, the third base coach of the Giants, right after this. Well, just to throw a few of these names out at you, Chipper Jones, you competed against him for years, obviously. What did you think of Chipper Jones?
Well, when I first got into the league, you know, if you were going to win or do anything in the playoffs, you had to go through Atlanta.
Yeah.
You know, they were the team. And he was one of the key components, one of the, you know, five guys. They had some, you know, they're going to have a lot of Hall of Famers out of Atlanta there, right? You got Maddox, you got Schmaltz, you already got those guys. But he's the other one that comes to mind, the mainstay, dangerous hitter. John said it in his comments, right or left-handed. And he played a very good third base.
Yeah.
You know, people maybe not look at him for his glove, but he was very smooth at third, good arm. But he was their guy. He was the dangerous hitter in the middle of the lineup. And when you pitched and navigated that lineup, you wanted to stay away from him because he's one of the key guys that was going to beat you.
You know, it's interesting. I did an interview with him, and the one thing he said before he got drafted by the Braves, he always remembered where he was when Sid Bream.
Uh-huh.
When Cabrera got the
hit.
And it made me think of something that we did on the podcast. You were a Pirate for many years.
Uh-huh.
Now, before you got really entrenched with the Giants, did you kind of follow the Pirates? Did you still have some affinity for the Pirates, even though you were with the Giants?
Yeah, you always watch the team you leave. I think every player does, to see what they're doing and how's it going. So when I first came over here, I had a stop in Baltimore, a brief stop, before I signed over with the Giants. But, yeah, I watched them. I mean, I was a Jim Leland fan. You know, when I was there, it was Chuck Tanner was the manager, and my last two spring trainings, or my last spring training with the Giants, was Jim Leland, and I really identified with him, his blue collar attitude and approach, and the way he talked to people and what he expected. And I remember when he sent me out in the major league camp. There was about a week left in camp, and he didn't know me, and I was hurt. I had a bad arm at the time. And I remember him sending me out. And I said, I understand, I get it, but I just want you to know, Jim, I'm better than the guys you got here. I told him on my way out, I'm better than the guy you're keeping. And
who'd they keep?
Well, it was Rafael Belliard was a pretty good defender.
Yes, he was.
Pretty good defender, but he wasn't much with the bat at the time. But, you know, I came up with him in the minor leagues. We were teammates, and I love him to death. But, you know, even he turned himself into a pretty good hitter in the major leagues and had a real nice career. But I couldn't throw the ball, and that was it for me. You know, the arm was the issue.
That's funny. How did you get to the Giants? I don't know if you've ever told that story.
No, maybe I have not. Well, I was in camp with Baltimore, and it was the one time I was released by an organization out of spring training on the last day. And, you know, I was out of a job for a month, and I was I was at home. Actually, I went to Nebraska. My sister-in-law was living there. I was working out at Creighton University to stay in shape. And you know who the manager of Creighton was at the time?
Jim Hendry.
Jim Hendry,
yeah.
Who became the GM of the Chicago Cubs. He was kind enough to let me work out there. And I finally got a call from the head of player development for the San Francisco Giants. And he coached for the Giants for a long time and still a close friend, Carlos Alfonso.
Ah, okay.
And Carlos had seen me play in the PCL for many, many years, and he offered me a AAA job in Phoenix with the team, and I took it and I signed and played the rest of that year and the following year in AAA. And I still couldn't throw the baseball, never made it back to the big leagues because the arm, I just lost the ability to play shortstop. So played out my 2 years there, and then Carlos actually offered me a coaching job in the minor leagues the following season. And I had a decision to make. I had a job to go play in Italy for Anzio Beach.
Okay.
I had an invite with the Mets to go to spring training. And I had a decision to make. Do I want to keep dragging this out? Because I couldn't throw the ball. I lost my niche to play shortstop, in my opinion. And I said, I'm going to make a career change. And I did. And it was a tough day. It was a tough day to say, you know, I'm giving up on my dream.
Yeah.
You know, I'm giving up on this, which, you know, I'd been there, but I just felt it was the right thing to do at the time. I had, you know, Lori was in my life, and there's insurance, and there's financial obligations, and I thought it was the right thing to do. And thank goodness I did, because I made the right decision.
How old were you?
I think I was only 28 or 29 at the time. Well, I played 11 years. I signed as 18 out of high school, and I played 11 seasons as a professional player, parts of three in, with the Pirates in the big leagues, and made a career change at, I think, probably 29.
Yeah, you, and I'm sure you still have friends from the Pirate days. You know, those
oh,
are
yeah.
friends you make for life, you know, early in life.
Absolutely. Well, one's on the other side here. Lee Tunnels, a bullpen coach for the Milwaukee Brewers. Our wives got together here, a teammate, a good friend. It's great to see him now and then in the big leagues. Not in the big leagues. When we go to Milwaukee, we get to see him. And a guy that I haven't seen all that much that had a lot to do with my playing career as a minor league player is Tommy Sant.
Sure.
Tommy Sant was on Leland's staff and went through those good years in Pittsburgh. And he was my AAA manager, my AA manager, and really was a big supporter of mine to get me to the big leagues, because there was one point that I didn't have a lot of supporters, and he was behind me. But he's coming to a game August 11th here. He's going to be here for the Bonds Hall of Fame
retirement.
Retirement. The jersey thing, and so I'm looking forward to seeing him. So he's coming out from them. Obviously, Barry played for him as well. Barry and I were teammates in Hawaii 1 year. Actually, people probably don't know that.
You and Barry Bonds?
Yes, yeah, for half a season. And
what
Tommy Sant
like?
Was the manager.
What was that like? What was that like?
Well, it was great. You know, we were in Hawaii. And, as you do in the minor leagues, you have a lot of fond memories, and you could see right away the talent that this guy had. I mean, this guy, when he came to us, he could run, he could throw, he could hit. The bat speed, that's really jumped off for me when you look at a player, is how quick his bat was.
Yeah.
He had tremendous bat speed. And, of course, he went on to be Barry Bonds.
Wow. Well, you got to get Tommy Sant on with us if he's here on
Sunday.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. No, he'd be a great guy to talk to. He can give you a lot of stories on Barry, which people would probably love to hear. I'll give him the offer.
And on you. You know,
well, we don't know if we want them talking about me on the radio.
Could you? Yeah, probably. You probably could go back on a pop-up, right? You were good at that.
Yeah, I could do that. I could catch the ball. Yeah.
All right. Very good. You didn't kick many, even though you're a soccer guy.
Yeah, that's right. I try to keep the two sports separate. Soccer and baseball and basketball are all a little bit different.
A three-sport athlete. Whoa. All right. Very good. Hey, we had fun yesterday, I want to tell you, with the Wall of Fame. And
uh-huh.
I didn't get to go out there in Carmen and Alley. I'll tell you what they were doing. They had fun, too. But we had Brian Wilson on the show with us.
Did you?
What a character. And I'll tell you this. If he would have talked like he talked yesterday,
uh-huh.
when he was here, he would have been amazing. But, you know, he had that enigma, you know, the beard and who knows what was in it and, you know, all that. But what a guy.
Great guy.
Brian Wilson, give me your thoughts on him.
Well, great guy. You mentioned it, that he really has a lot of personality, and I think the people yesterday saw him talking in front of the mic, but he had a good bit. You know, he had fear of the beard. He kept quiet. Everything was about baseball, and I have a lot of respect for him because he was two different guys, really, his professional approach and then the person that he was, and as you said, the people really didn't know the real Brian, and he shared a little bit of that yesterday with everybody. Great player, great personality, and as you heard the stories from Vogie and Matt Cain, a real gamer, a great teammate, a motivator. You know, he was all business. And you love to see that fire and that passion. And all three of those guys that were there yesterday had it. And, Brian Wilson, great, great, great guy. I'm happy to see him on the wall. He definitely deserves that.
Yeah, what a story. The way, you know, he said, well, of course, you know, torture. You know, Dwayne,
right.
The torture thing. But he said, look, I was not going to give in.
Yep.
And I knew if I went 3, you know, I knew I could throw the ball. And Rob Nen taught him this. And, you know, you don't have to throw a strike.
Right.
And he knew it. But it must have driven you guys nuts.
Yes and no. I mean, there was times, obviously, but I knew in my heart he wasn't wild, that he was going to throw the strike when he needed to throw the strike.
Yeah.
Certain guys, it's like Dan Stanhouse, right? I played with him in Hawaii. You talked about
full pack.
Yeah. He'd go 3-2 on everybody, but you knew that he could throw the strike when he needed to throw the strike. Stanhouse was the same way. I played behind him, and he's hitting, missing, boom, and then he throws the strike. And Brian was the same way. So I remember when he first big league start, you know, Rags talked about it yesterday at the ceremony, which, by the way, of all the ceremonies I've seen here, and the Giants do them right, I enjoyed that one more than anyone I've ever been a part of.
Why was that?
Well, I think it has to do with the people that I lived it with them and was able to hear their stories about each other, listen to Rags talk. I think it was just closer to home. A lot of times we have these ceremonies, it was 20 years ago, or, you know, it was closer to home. And I thought it was so fun for me to be there to kind of, you know, look at them through the stories they told, a little different prism than being in the moment of coaching and playing ball games. So I really enjoyed it, but I lost my train of thought.
Why it was special, and with these guys and Brian Wilson, it brought it back. And what for me, and I think Brian Wilson said it as well, it's just the beginning of celebrating what was amazing. It's just the beginning of it. Of these three guys, now they've changed the rules where you're going to get the other relievers on
right
there, too. And that's the thing for me. You know, we have Mays, McCovey, Cepeda, and we have that era, and, they come out. It's wonderful.
Right.
But now the golden era of Giants baseball is going to be celebrated, and this was just the beginning. And he told a story. What a character. A character.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of stories, as they said yesterday, that could be told. But those guys had a lot of fun. And when you win and you're good like they are, that's what fun is. That's what fun is. And they certainly had this separation between having the fun and enjoying what they're doing and playing the game the way it's supposed to be played when you get on the field.
Now they're world champions. It doesn't happen by accident.
Right.
As we now know, going through these seasons, it doesn't happened by accident. And just to hear Wilson talk, and I said, what was your thought process when Nelson Cruz was up and, you know, you were in the game? He thought Lincecum was going to finish the game.
Right.
He said, but then they're calling me in, and I was on the mound, and I'm throwing the last pitch to Cruz, and before I threw it, I said, he was in nirvana. And he said, when I get him out, all he thought about was San Francisco and the people and what was going to go on in San Francisco and bringing the world championship. It was a very deep moment for a guy. As you say, there was the persona that we got.
Right.
And then who he really was, and we got to see it yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was.
I was impressed.
That's why I enjoyed it so much, listening to them tell these stories and watching it from a different perspective. But I think going back to what I was saying, you're talking about him as a closer, I remember it was a game in Colorado. Then Rags spoke about it. His first game, he threw his clicker. He ended up getting thrown out of the game, so he missed him pitching. He threw two innings for us. And that's the first time I had seen him throw, was in that game in Colorado. And my goodness, the first inning I saw, I said, this guy is our closer. This guy can pitch. And it brings a smile to your face when you see a player come up with that type of command and stuff. He dominated. And you know you have something special.
Oh, very good. All right, Carmen, Allie, as I'm thinking of what we did yesterday, you weren't there for Brian Wilson.
No.
You didn't get to hear it. It was terrific. But tell Will what you guys were doing. Listen to what they were doing yesterday while we were doing the show. Go ahead, Carmen.
We were walking around with Chef Toussaint Potter. If you don't know him, he's the executive chef at AT&T. And he was showing us behind the scenes of all the food. So I got to make a pizza and eat the pizza. I got to, watch how they make garlic fries.
I also got to eat the pizza. I was camera. So I just got to enjoy the benefits of
He helped me. He paired a champagne from France with a crab sandwich for me, and it was delicious.
Really?
I ate a lot yesterday. It was really great.
That's a great. Can I go next time? Can I be invited to this?
Probably.
I'll be the camera guy.
Yeah.
So don't take my job.
And they're going to make a video.
Right. Sorry, Ellie.
And you're going to make a video.
Yeah, I'm probably going to make several videos because it was 2 hours of just eating and looking at the food and whatever. But it's going to be on McCovey Chronicles after I edit it.
Yeah, that'd be great. I want to see that because, you know, people ask you, what do you think of the garlic fries? What do you think of this and that? I don't eat any of the food here, and I bet you it's a wonderful, wonderful video to
watch. Did you ask him Chef T, as we like to call him, what he would eat if he was at the park. Did you ask him that question?
Oh, yeah, he said crab sandwich. Mm-hmm. He said crab sandwich.
Crab sandwich.
Or the other chef that was with him said tri-tip sandwich mm-hmm. from center field. He said basically in that center field area, that's where, like, the gourmet kind of what the best food is out in AT&T Park.
Well, I think we should have a cook-off between Chef T and Matt. Our chef. I think we should have a little competition with these two, and we can be the judges. We can be the judges. I watch a lot of the Food Network, so I think I can handle this.
I watch a lot of Top Chef, so I know how to critique.
We could set that up. We'll get Maria. Maria will set that up. This is very good. All right, but they had fun yesterday, so that's what the ballpark is all about. Going back to a little bit of the Hall of Fame, I know you got to run, and we could talk all day with you. Vladimir Guerrero, how about him?
Wow, yeah. Well, what comes to mind with him is in Montreal when he was a young player, was such a dangerous hitter, and he had that long reach. You know, I mean, you couldn't throw the ball on the plate because you could throw it 3 inches outside and he'd still hit the darn thing. He could hit a bad ball hitter, long reach. You had to throw him in to get him out. And the scary thing about that is you better have velocity. You better hit your spot because now you're throwing it right into his wheelhouse. So, and then, you know, Felipe came over and had managed him all those years, and Felipe knew him like the back of our hand. The guy still beat us every night, right? Because he was that good of a hitter. But the one quick thing that comes to mind is a throw that he made in Montreal in the old stadium, Olympic Stadium, in right field. And I don't remember who the runner is. Maybe it was Sinjo. I'm not sure. A ball was hit and it kicked around. He picked it up on the warning track in right field and threw a missile to home plate and nailed our runner out at home plate. And your jaw dropped. You know, you just never expected to see that type of throw. Yeah. So that's what comes to mind with Vladimir Guerrero.
Yeah, amazing bad ball hitter. You played with Manny Sanguin, or at least you knew of Manny Sanguin. He was the best I ever saw. This guy would hit the ball after it bounced.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, come on. I mean, how about that?
Yeah, I'd done it a couple times, hadn't he? Yeah.
How about that? Yeah, and the last one is Hoffman. And, of course, Bruce Bochy is back there now for the Hall of Fame induction of Trevor Hoffman and Alan Trammell, who's a shortstop like you. But how about Trevor Hoffman?
You know, he's if you look at Trevor and you look at his delivery from a coach's perspective, you just love the way he threw the ball. He had the build, he had the great delivery, and he had the great command.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you were teaching a pitcher to pitch, you'd want to look at Trevor Hoffman and what he did. And that's what made him so good was his command. Now, he had very, very good stuff, and I think he got hurt at one point and came up with that changeup. But the command, because of the delivery and in the pitcher he was really his distinction to a big degree, how well he could hit those corners. You know, like Vogelsong and some of the guys were talking about Wilson. Yeah. And then the last thing is, obviously, he's one of a few guys that when you think of a pitcher, you think of a pitch. When you think of Mariano Rivera, you think of the cutter, right? That made him. You think of Trevor Hoffman, especially the second half of his career, what do you think of?
Changeup.
The changeup.
Yeah.
And you knew it was coming, and you still couldn't hit it. Great pitcher.
Isn't that funny? And, you know, and Bochy's back there for this. But knowing Bochy, we've seen him manage. You've been with him for a number of years. You won championships with him. Can you imagine how excited Bochy must have been to have this guy as his closer?
Oh, boy.
You know how he handles a bullpen.
You kidding me? I mean,
to know that's at the end.
Well, that's security too. I mean, you know, the ninth inning is taken care of, and you know, when you don't want to lose games late, and a closer is a very important piece of the puzzle. But I'm happy Boch is there, being able to enjoy this moment. You know, having Trevor for all those years and everything they've done in San Diego, and of course Trammell as well. He worked with Alan Trammell as well. So I'm happy for Boch to be there. I'm sure he's going to enjoy the moment if he can stay awake, because he took the red eye last night and then had to drive, what, an hour and a half to get there. Yeah. So, I hope he has a great day. I'm sure he will.
Yeah, I'm having a good time.
There you go.
That was a good Bochy, huh?
Yeah, very good.
Not
very
bad.
Good. Yeah.
Not bad. Boy, good stuff.
Carmen says no, Marty.
Carmen says no. Carmen's my biggest critic. You know that.
No.
All right. Great stuff. Well, very good. Very good. We covered a lot of ground. This was very good. So I appreciate all the time. And let's see. Next week, Arizona for you. And then we'll see you for Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
When Pittsburgh's here.
Then I'll check with Tommy Sant and see if he's going to be here. Do you know what day the Bonds?
It's the 11th.
It's the 11th?
Yeah, August 11th.
Is that a Sunday?
It's a Saturday.
It's a Saturday.
Okay.
Oh, he could be here. Okay.
All right.
All right.
Yeah, we get him on here. All right. Well, have a good day.
Thank you.
I think the Giants are going to win today.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
All right.
All right. More coming up right after this on the Sports Leader.